Okay, good afternoon. We're going to get started here in a minute. Please join me in welcoming Jerry Soderholm DeFonte on his topic of black integration in the major leagues, a different perspective. Welcome, Jerry.
Am I okay? Oh, sounds good. Batting seventh for the St. Louis Browns, number seven, second baseman, Hank Thompson. Yep. Back on July 17th, 66 years ago, Hank Thompson made his major league debut less than 2 weeks after Larry Doby made his with the Cleveland Indians. Now, Doby was the first black to play in the American League. But in that first inaugural season of integration in 1947, Hank Thompson got far more playing time and was the more consequential player, as was, for that matter, his teammate Willard Brown, who made his big league debut 2 days later. Now, Doby started in only one of the 29 games he appeared in for Cleveland in 47 and struck out in a third of his plate appearances. Hank Thompson started 18 games at second base, appearing in 27 overall, before the Browns decided, after only 5 weeks and 4 days, that neither Thompson nor Willard Brown were up to Major League snuff and terminated their Major League contract, sending them back to the Kansas City Monarchs. Meanwhile, back east, east of the East River in Brooklyn, Jackie Robinson was shivering the timbers of Major League Baseball's segregationist pillars. Now, the standard narrative on integration rightfully celebrates Jackie Robinson and the great players who followed in his immediate footsteps, who proved that blacks were capable of playing at the Major League level. Their excellence ensured that by the mid-1950s, black players with superior talent would find a place in Major League starting lineups. But by 1960, even by 1960, it was not a certainty that black players of more modest abilities, the likes of Tony Taylor or Leon Wagner or Earl Wilson or perhaps even Curt Flood, would have been regulars on Major League rosters in the 1960s, as they were, in fact were. Now, these were good players, certainly of Major League caliber, but compared to their colleagues, their contemporaries here in the left-hand column, they were not so good that they would necessarily have gotten starting assignments. These players in the right-hand column, in their first five full big league seasons, as starting position players, starting pitchers, or in the case of John Wyatt, ace reliever, had an average annual player value of less than 2 wins above what a replacement-level player would have contributed to his team. And 2 wins above replacement is at the bottom of the range of performance that would be expected of a regular in the major leagues. Now, unlike the difference between a perennial all-star or a perennial MVP candidate and everybody else in the big leagues, the variability in performance among most players who are regulars in the major leagues is not quite that obvious. And in the 1950s, black players whose talent was not indisputably superior to those whites they were competing against were not necessarily going to get a fair chance to win a position over a white player with comparable or even inferior skills. Consequently, without in any way diminishing the importance or the legacy of Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby, integration could not be considered consolidated until big league teams allowed any black player with major league ability, not just elite players, to realistically compete for a starting position in the major leagues. May the best man win. When Jackie Robinson retired after 10 major league seasons, 78 blacks had played in the big time. Of those 78 who made their major league debut by the end of the 1956 season, 19 could claim by the end of the decade, in 1960, to have been a regular on his team for at least 5 seasons. But the more significant number is that 11 of those 19 were elite players, an elite player being defined as either one whose average annual player value put him among the very top tier of the starting position players or starting pitchers in his league, or a player whose career arc ultimately wound him up in Cooperstown. And in fact, 9 of these 11 players in boldface here are in fact in the Hall of Fame, and the 2 who are not, Don Newcomb and Minnie Minoso, were both good enough that in recent years their names were submitted to the Veterans Committee for reconsideration. Now, think about that number for a minute. 11 out of 19. That's nearly 60%. The comparable figure for white players playing at least 5 years as a regular between 47 and 1960, only 16% were elite players. Of the 8 blacks who played at least 5 years during that time, the only one who succeeded in doing so before 1953 was Hank Thompson. For the others, it was almost certainly necessary for the first wave of integration's trailblazers to prove they could compete with the best of the white players before blacks of more average ability could realistically do the same. In this regard, it's not surprising, probably, that 5 of the 10 best National League position players between 1947, Jackie's rookie season, and 1960, based on cumulative wins above replacement for their 5 best consecutive years, 5 of the top 10 were blacks. Black players, in fact, dominated the top half of that list in the National League, counting for 3 of the top 4, 4 of the top 6, and all 5 had an average annual player value exceeding the 5 wins above replacement that denotes an all-star level quality of play. Mays and Jackie Robinson averaged better than 8 wins above replacement in their 5 best years. That's playing at an MVP level. And Banks and Aaron are right below that. Meanwhile, over on the other side of the ledger, the fact that only 2 of the 10 best American League players during those years were black players probably tells you something about that league's dragging its heel when it came to integration. Now, Major League Baseball may have been slow to integrate, but the immediate competitive success of both the Dodgers and the Indians, once the color barrier was broken, and their aggressive signing of black players for their minor league systems, did not go unnoticed. In 1952, and we are now talking 6 years deep into the Jackie Robinson era, there were 170 major league players who were regulars that season, based on a position player either starting, or a position player starting 100 games at his position, or a pitcher either throwing enough innings to qualify for the ERA title or otherwise appearing in 14 games. 170 players, only 11 of whom were black. Of course, Mays and Newcomb were missing in action at this time, being draft picks for the U.S. Army. Only 6 major league teams had blacks on their big league roster, but 7 others had blacks with their minor league affiliates, suggesting that they were hedging their bets about the future of blacks in Major League Baseball, even as they remained opposed to the idea of integration at the big league level. And that included the Red Sox and the Yankees, who of course would become notorious in terms of holding out against giving blacks the opportunity in the big time. Now, not to excuse the reluctance of most major league owners to go down the path of integration, at least not quickly, one can argue that the lack of opportunity given to black players who weren't superior talents in the first decade of integration was almost certainly a practical consideration on the part of the teams that owned their contracts. Even the enlightened teams were careful not to push the envelope of integration too far, too fast, beyond what they assessed to be comfort level of their fan base, and most importantly, especially in the American League, their fellow big league owners. And they didn't want to cause any more disruption than necessary in major league clubhouses where white players were skeptical, wary, or downright hostile to the idea of having a black teammate. Consequently, even teams at the forefront of integration, like the Brooklyn Dodgers, adhered to an implicit quota through most of the 1950s that limited the number of blacks on big league rosters to a handful. This put a premium on favoring elite black players for major league jobs, because teams either knew or calculated that for most white players, for whom it might have been obvious as early as 1950 that there was no going back to segregated baseball, for most white players, accepting as a teammate a black with superior talent is one thing, an obstacle that can be overcome. After all, terrific talent cannot be denied. But having to compete against a black player of comparable ability for highly competitive and scarce major league jobs, well, that's another thing entirely, a far more difficult obstacle to overcome. So throughout virtually the entirety of Jackie Robinson's career, black players who were not themselves exceptional talents were rarely, if ever, given the chance to realistically compete, even for a position that was a weakness on the major league team in whose system they belonged. Still, at some point, some team was going to step up with its own fairness doctrine and give a starting opportunity to a black player who didn't have an impressive Negro League resume or superstar potential. That team would not be the Brooklyn Dodgers, but the New York Giants, who won their last two pennants in New York with black players playing major roles who were not named, Mays and Irvin, as important as both of those were to the team. Of the first eight players to emerge as regulars over many successive seasons in the major leagues, and in order of chronological order, they would be Robinson and Doby, Campanella and Newcomb, Thompson and Irvin, Minoso and Mays. Hank Thompson alone among them was not an exceptional talent, so good that he could not be denied once the color barrier had been broken. In fact, when he and Monty Irvin integrated the New York Giants in July of 1949, Hank Thompson's prospects were at best uncertain. He had failed, after all, only 2 years before in his first try with the St. Louis Browns. But manager Leo DeRocher made him the Giants' regular second baseman for the remainder of the 49 season. And then after they acquired Eddie Stanky, he became the Giants' third baseman. For 7 years, Hank Thompson was a starting position player for the New York Giants. But he was not a great player. He was never an all-star. Based on similarity scores developed by Bill James to compare players, the contemporary to whom he was most similar would have been Chicago Cubs third baseman Randy Jackson, which is kind of precisely the point. Hank Thompson was not so good that the New York Giants couldn't have settled on a white guy to fulfill their infield needs had they wanted to. They could have stayed with Bill Rigney at second base or promoted Billy Gardner, a promising prospect in their minor league system who had become a regular second baseman in the American League for 5 years during the mid-1950s. But they gave the opportunity to Hank Thompson, who became the first black player for many successive seasons to be a regular in the major leagues, who was not himself an exceptional player. And the New York Giants were also the first team to integrate into their starting rotation a black pitcher who did not have the ability to overpower hitters or being a dominating ace, like the Dodgers' Don Newcomb. His name was Ruben Gomez. While Newcomb had such exceptional stuff that he was always a potential 20-game winner, Gomez was merely a reliable pitcher. Newcomb did, in fact, win 20 games three times, and 19 another season, and lost 2 years to the Korean War in the prime of his career. The most games Ruben Gomez ever won was 17. Newcomb was one of the best pitchers of his era. Gomez was not even the ace on his own staff. He was never a National League All-Star, but he was the workhorse starting in at least 30 games for the Giants every year between 54 and 58. The player to whose career arc his was most similar was 1940s right-hander Bill Voisel, as in Spawn and Sane and pray for Voisel to maybe win if it doesn't rain. Back in the borough of Brooklyn, the team that deserves all credit for breaking the color barrier was itself risk-averse for many years to give a starting opportunity to black players who were not themselves exceptional talents, a point that Roger Kahn, the great baseball writer from the 1950s, has emphasized. But the Dodgers had been building an impressive pipeline of black players in their minor league system, who by the early 1950s, a number of them were clearly ready to play in the major leagues, but none of them had the talent level approaching Robinson, Campanella, and Newcomb. In 1953, they promoted Jim Gilliam to the major leagues to replace Jackie Robinson at second base, the plan being to gracefully shift Jackie's diminishing skill set over to third base. Now, despite the fact that Gilliam had been the International League MVP the year before, despite an outstanding spring training in 53, and despite the Dodgers' culture of accepting black players, Roger Kahn observed at the time that among some of the white Brooklyn Dodgers there was considerable resentment and anger towards Gilliam because he was displacing from the starting lineup the popular Billy Cox. Now, Cox was a terrific defensive third baseman, but most years that he was a regular in the Brooklyn lineup, his average player value was barely above that of a replacement level player. And major league players understand that it is incumbent upon a major league team to improve upon that if they can. And in that regard, it's interesting to note that Roger Kahn also observed that there was not the same level of resentment or anger shown towards two white guys, Bobby Morgan and Don Hope, who were also competing for Billy Cox's job. Anyway, Gilliam wins the Rookie of the Year in 53, the start of a 14-year odyssey with the Dodgers in which he helped contribute to six pennants. But he too was never a great player. The contemporary to whom he would be most similar would be Pete Reynolds, another versatile infielder with a 14-year career. The Dodgers kept incrementally adding black players to their rosters for the remaining years at Ebbets Field, but none of them really were more than marginal major leaguers. None had long careers in the major leagues. The best known among them is Sandy Amoros, and he only because Yogi was robbed in the seventh inning of the seventh game of the 55 World Series, you know, the only one that Brooklyn won when they were in Brooklyn. 1956 is Jackie Robinson's last season. That's 10 years deep into the integration era. 173 players were regulars in the major leagues that season. Based on the criteria I established earlier, only 21 of them, including Jackie Robinson, was black. So for those who might still have been arguing that actually there are very few black players capable of playing in the major leagues, and that the Dodgers' success with integration was entirely attributable to the fact that Robinson, Campanella, and Newcomb just kind of happened to be as good as some of the best of the white guys. Well, the Milwaukee Braves had an answer by winning back-to-back pennants in 57 and 58, and nearly again in 59, with five blacks on their roster playing instrumental roles, only one of whom, Hank Aaron, was a standout player. The four others were inconsequential, basically, as far as baseball history is concerned. The most successful among them was probably Billy Bruton, who in 8 years as a center fielder for the Milwaukee Braves had a career arc that most resembled that of Bill Verdon and Jimmy Pearsall. I would argue that the team that had the biggest impact on broadening the acceptance among major league teams to giving starting opportunities to black players who were not elite talents were the 1959 Los Angeles Dodgers, who unexpectedly won the pennant and the World Series that year with Robinson, Campanella, and Newcomb no longer in Dodger blue and four black players playing key instrumental roles. I've already mentioned Jim Gilliam. About Charlie Neal, all I will say is his career was most similar to that of Yankees second baseman Billy Martin. Johnny Roseborough was one of the better catchers in the National League in the first half of the 60s, but let's face it, Roy Campanella, he was not. And the only one of these four to gain any Hall of Fame consideration from the Baseball Writers Association of America was Maury Wills, and he never came close to Cooperstown enshrinement. The fact that black players were instrumental to the success of every National League pennant winner from 51 to 59 was changing the face of Major League Baseball. But even in 1960, 14 years deep into the integration era, and 4 years after Jackie Robinson had retired, there were still only 27 blacks among the 171 players who were regulars in the major leagues based on either 100 position games started or pitchers qualifying for the ERA title or otherwise appearing in 40 games. And a third of them appeared on just two teams, the Dodgers and the Giants. So the highlighted bottom line would seem to suggest that not all that much progress had been made on the integration front from the time Jackie Robinson retired until 1960. The percentage of blacks among total starting players in the major leagues had increased from only 12% in 56 to 16% in 1960. But the powers that be in Major League Baseball were paying attention to the impact that black players could have. 4 years later, in 1964, more than a quarter of the players who were regulars in the major leagues were black players. And indicative of integration being consolidated in the 1960s, 35% of the players, blacks counted for 35% of the position players who were regulars in major league lineups for at least 5 years between 1961 and 1970. But how much had things really changed? And the only reason I'm asking that question is because the title of this study, published in late summer 1967, by a social science researcher, would suggest, well, not all that much. Using data from the mid-50s to the 60s that showed that black position players hit for disproportionately much higher batting averages than their white counterparts, the study concluded two things, and I'm quoting here. First, the Negro ball player may have to be better qualified than the white player to win the same position. And second, nevertheless, such discrimination places little handicap on the outstanding Negro because he is too valuable a property to exclude. Well, this is a basic summation of my thesis for the 1950s, except it's written long after there's no longer any doubt about blacks in Major League Baseball. Now, one can argue whether or not his data set actually says anything meaningful about the opportunities for blacks in the 1960s. After all, he may have been looking at a particularly great generation of black ball players. I think more to the point is that the percentage of elite players among position players who were regulars in the major leagues for at least 5 years between 61 and 1970, the percentage of elite players was substantially higher among black major league players than among white major league players. Specifically, this graphic breaks it down between National League on the top, American League on the bottom, but I'm going to give you the major league aggregate. That is, 35% of blacks who were regulars for at least 5 years during that time were elite players, compared to only 13% of the white players who were regulars for at least 5 years. An elite player, again, is one whose cumulative wins above replacement over five best years accounts for at least, makes him one of the 10 best position players in the league, or a player whose career path leads him ultimately to the Hall of Fame. So even in the 1960s, the significant disproportion strongly indicated that there was still, the odds still overwhelmingly favored the average white major leaguer to the black major leaguer. It would not be until the next decade that Major League Baseball, reflecting the better nature of American society, would put the issue of integration behind it. Players would earn their position based on fair competition without regard to racial considerations. May the best man win. Thank you very much. I don't think that was the reason. I don't exactly remember with regard to Clemente what the reason was, but the Dodgers had traded some other talented black players, specifically Sam Jethro, from their minor league system, in his case, to the Boston Braves, I think for precisely that purpose. Yes? Oh, sorry.
You had mentioned a quota on rosters. From what I have read, one of the things that also is a quota on the number of starting players in any given game couldn't have more black players. In fact, I think that was one of the issues with the Giants. They did not want to have five black players on the field at the same time. So, like Roy Dandridge was kept down in the minor league because of that.
All I'll say about that is that Hank Aaron, in his autobiography, I Had a Hammer, makes that point specifically about the Braves in 57, 58, and 59, claiming that in 1959, that's what ultimately cost them the pennant.
All the way in back.
That's a really provocative notion, because I think the fact that the Yankees were so successful all those years certainly did have an impact. But I'm also of the belief that, you know, kind of getting back to what I was saying at the very beginning, being the practical consideration, I really do think, as unfair as it may have seemed, that people wanted to see proven time and again that these guys could play with the best of the white guys before blacks of more average ability would really get that opportunity.
Society in really all facets of American life.
Well, I think a lot has been sort of written about baseball being sort of at the forefront of sort of the civil rights movement. And I would argue with, I don't know that much about other sports, but my impression is that Major League Baseball was far ahead of other sports, even in terms of, first in terms of getting blacks the opportunity at all, and then in terms of more average players being able to, you know, work their way into starting positions.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah, it seems to me to get a really full picture, you'd have to do a little more of something you did briefly, which is to look at signing people, developing people, how many people did teams have in the minor leagues. And I just want to make one comment about that. Here, the Dodgers, led by Pavese, really took the lead and had a second-generation team with, as you pointed out, Wills, Roseboro, Tommy Davis, Willie Davis, and that team helped dominate the National League in the 60s. Now, some years ago, for reasons that will become apparent in a moment, I got interested in the fact that that pipeline seemed to dry up in the 70s, and with the exception of David Lopes, the people the Dodgers developed were white. And I discovered that Pavese went to the Padres, of course, in 1969, and the guy who replaced him as director of personnel was a guy named Al Campanis. So even in the most progressive organization, perhaps it depended on who was running the show.
Rick Swain wrote a couple of books, which are in McFarland Press, and I don't know whether they're actually being for sale today, in which he kind of addresses that issue. And one of the points he makes is that there were a lot of black players in minor league systems, you know, all teams. I mentioned, for example, that 13 of the 16 major league teams as early as 1952 had blacks somewhere in their system, even if only six had them at the major league level. So they were hedging their bets about blacks in Major League Baseball. One of the unfortunate things was, until essentially blacks had proven themselves, or whatever, however you want to phrase it, in terms of their ability to play with the best of the white guys, black players weren't given a very long leash. If you got hurt, or a black player who was given a starting opportunity but wasn't so talented was struggling in that role, teams were very quick to give up on them, send them back to the minor league. Sometimes they would never return. And Sam Jethro and Luke Easter, I think, are two players who were very talented, both of whom suffered from that actually happening to them, neither of whom had a career of more than 3 years in the major leagues.
Please join me in thanking
Set.